This is Voice of Benbridge. I'm Philippe Boucher. Our guest today is Chris Tunley, who unfortunately had an accident not a long time ago. And he's going to talk about with us about that today. Can you tell us exactly what happened to you?
Oh, sure. On April 16th, I was bicycling north on Highway 305. I was about 400 feet short of the Day Road intersection there, which is actually where I was going to turn off of 305. And unfortunately, a woman who was a few cars behind me, her cell phone went off, and she started looking for the cell phone. When she did that, she took her eyes off the road and turned to her right, which also caused the steering wheel to slightly move to the right. And so she came up from behind me. I was on the section between the white line and where the grass grows. And she hit me, and the estimates are some place between 45 and 50 miles an hour.
Oh, that's pretty fast.
That is very fast.
It's on the highway, so she was within the speed limit.
She was going the speed of the traffic, which is actually less than the speed limit. The speed limit there is 55, so she may have been going 10 miles under the speed limit. At the moment that her car touched my rear tire, things started to happen. I have no memory myself of the accident. My mind is blocking on the accident and the day before, so I can't even remember the classes that I taught the day before. The first thing that happened with me is I think I was actually looking over my right shoulder, because my injuries are worse on my right side than my left side. My guess is I heard her coming up behind me, and I was starting to either start to look around or I was looking around. Upon impact, the bicycle suddenly went from probably 8-10 miles an hour to 45 miles an hour. And the seat stem, the stem that holds the seat on the bicycle, sheared off because the tension was too great, which is rather good because I'd rather have the bicycle seat going backwards with me instead of trying to get through my legs at that kind of speed. Essentially, I would stay in about the same spot, and the car moves underneath me, and my back hit her windshield, and then my head snapped back and hit the roof of her car, leaving a very significant dent in the car and pretty messy, shattering my helmet.
Fortunately, you had the helmet.
Right? Yes. I'm actually a member of the local bicycle advocacy group. And some of the other members of the group, when they heard I had been injured, said, "Chris? How could it happen to Chris? He does all the safety things." I always wear a helmet. I always have bright colors on. I always have a flasher on, all that stuff.
What time of the day was that?
It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
So it was full day.
Full daylight, when someone's not looking.
Well, it's just distraction. The distraction, yeah.
They were paying attention to something else. People need to pay more attention to driving. A sort of miraculous thing happened, which happens. The car windshield's sort of like a golf club, and I'm sort of like a golf ball. So she's hit me with enough force that actually threw me forward and slightly to the right, 80 feet.
Jeez.
And I've gone and looked at the side of the accident, and I can't believe I didn't hit anything. So I actually end up landing on a small patch of grass, not hitting the rock wall next to me, not hitting the guardrail that I just got. So I was on the opposite side of the guardrail from traffic, so I was safe from getting run over or anything like that. My helmet had blown off partway through my flight, so I landed without a helmet on. Looking at my clothing after the accident, my guess is I landed on my back. According to the police report, I was still conscious but incoherent, because they asked me if I was married, and I couldn't tell them whether I was married or not, which I usually keep track of that sort of item. People pulled over. Several people were witnesses to the accident. The woman who was in the car, she felt the impact and then looked up, and by then I was gone.
Yeah.
And so she saw the cracked windshield, and she pulled over. She pulled over just north of the Day Road exit. And my guess is someone came up to her and told her what had happened. She was very distressed at the scene. And I've talked to people who drove past the scene, and they said it was very strange, because they couldn't see a bunch of banged up cars. They were looking for banged up cars, but they could see this woman who was crying her head off. So this poor woman who hit me was you know, just in feeling terrible that she had taken her eyes off the road and done such a thing. Another person who saw the accident saw where I had landed and went over there and held my hand until the EMTs, the emergency medical people, came. Someone else who saw the accident dialed 911, and I've heard different stories.
With a cell phone.
with a cell phone, of course. And when asked where the location was, a story I heard, I don't know if this is true or not, but these are stories I hear, they didn't know. And so a bicyclist who had also seen the accident grabbed the cell phone from her hand, according to the story I heard, and said, "We are at on 305, just short of Day Road. Someone has been very badly injured. People need to get here right away. He'll probably need to be medevaced out, taken by helicopter." So then the emergency people came. They took me by ambulance down to the Madison Avenue Fire Station, where I was loaded on a helicopter. It turns out that the most experienced helicopter team was on duty that day, which is very important. They also had a protocol drug. They either gave me the standard drug that people would give for people going into shock like this, or they gave me an experimental drug. Since it's a double-blind test, nobody knows yet. We're thinking I got the experimental drug because, as the story goes on, you'll hear. So then I was flown to Harborview Hospital, where I was transferred to another ambulance and then transferred into the hospital and went into the emergency room. Now, at this time, other things were happening because the police were trying to contact my family, and the police had made a slight mistake. They had retained my driver's license, so by the time I got to the hospital, they didn't know who I was. Actually, one of the bills I received from one of the ambulances that moved me around has my last name misspelled because they didn't know who I was. So I got to the hospital and I became a John Doe. They went through my personal effects and they found my business card. And they called the school that I worked at and got a check on my ID, and then they found out who I was. I'm Chris Stanley. So then the police had called my house, I think, and then they came by, and my daughter was here, and they talked to her, and about that time she called my wife and told my wife that I had been in a serious accident. So then my wife, she's a physician, closed down her business and went to the hospital to find me. The police knew that I had a significant head injury, and they knew that I had a broken leg, probably, because it was all cattywampus. And I was having trouble breathing, so that I think the emergency medical people put a tube down my throat so they could keep me breathing. I had a collapsed lung at that point. So then, in the first 24 hours of the hospital, I believe I had 3 surgeries. The first surgery was to stop the bleeding in my abdomen. There was things that were, you know, bruised and damaged. My lungs were bruised. I had a collapsed lung. So the first thing that they do is blood. You don't want, person will bleed to death ahead of anything else. That's always the first thing you do, is stop the bleeding. So they worked on the bleeding. Then the next thing they worried about was my neck, because I had a significant neck injury. And so then after I came out of the first surgery, then I went into another surgery with a different team. This is the neck team. They opened up my neck and said, "Oh, my goodness. All the ligaments between 2 of my vertebrae were broken." So my neck was in what they call a very fragile position. There had been an extension and a twisting, as my head flipped back onto the roof of the car. Don't know whether it's the car or the landing on the ground, but some way or another, my neck got messed up. My guess is the car. They say it is very rare in the case of this kind of damage or pulling back that there's not spine damage. I believe in everything that we've checked out. My leg now can be moved around a little. is that I have no significant nerve damage, that I will walk again and all this. And so this is just amazing to the doctors. There are a number of things that are pretty amazing about what happened to me. So they put a titanium plate to screw those two vertebrae together, and they put some bone in there so that the two bones would become like one bone to make up for the fact that there are no ligaments holding them together anymore. After they finished that surgery, they flipped me over. Apparently some part of my back... This is a gruesome story. We should advise people not to listen to this if they have a weak stomach or just before...
We'll do a warning, you know, like this is restricted, or beware that this can contain some information,
yes,
that could cause some distress to the listener. But I think it's fascinating, too, that you can recall, reconstruct, rather.
So then...
time to think about it.
Once they had secured my neck and had it an appropriate brace and secured it, they said the only way it could be secured is internally. Then they flipped me over and another team came in, and I had what they call a degloving incident on my back. And so if you have a glove on your hand, when you peel it off, sort of goes inside out and stuff like that. Well, think of that as your skin. So essentially I had a section of my back that had caught on the car somewhere or caught on something somewhere and peeled back a 20 by 20 centimeter section of skin. And of course I landed on my back, so it took them 2 hours to clean out all the debris and clean out the back and put in a drain so that as liquid collected in there it would drain.
Very
out.
Serious surgery, then, I'd say.
Yeah, and that's a long time. Yeah. So my wife has since gone back and looked at a lot of the surgical reports, and she says they're all extenuating circumstances, and the surgeries took longer than normal and stuff like that. Wonderful. I mean, if you're ever in an accident, the place you want to end up is Harborview. Wonderful teams. I got there early enough in the day that the week team hadn't gone home, and I got stuck with a weekend team. It was just, I mean, they did phenomenal
stuff.
Well,
it was perfect timing those days.
And so that was three surgeries, and then they waited a few days for the swelling to go down in my leg before they dealt with the leg. And then my leg has a stainless steel post that runs from just below my knee to just above my ankle, and then they sort of put the bones together, or they ran it through there. Anyway, there are four breaks, and some of them look like mosaics, and it's just a mess, but it is healing. And hopefully, and they did a beautiful job. I really like the way my foot lines up with my knee. It looks just like it used to. And so I'm hopeful that it'll be a really good...
And when will that, from now?
Let's see, where are we? It'll be about 10 weeks. 10 weeks tomorrow. Tomorrow's
That's
Friday.
That's not such a long period of time.
Not a long period of time. I was in intensive care for about a week, and I was not conscious during that whole time, although I had a most amazing dream. The dream I had was that I was on this incredible bed, and it was a hospital bed, and it was very supportive, that it would if your body moved, it would rise up to hold you. And I think that's actually how these beds work. They're fluid beds. And I'm on this bed, and I'm shrinking. I'm getting smaller and smaller. And I'm wondering if I'm going down to nothing. And my wife tells me when I first woke up that I told her that I had dreamt that I had died. I don't remember dreaming that I had died, but I do remember the dream where I'm shrinking. And I'm shrinking and I'm shrinking. I'm not sure whether or not I'm going to go to nothing. And then suddenly I start growing again. And I'm getting bigger and bigger. And when I return to full size, that's when I remember waking up. And when I woke up, my wife says the first thing I asked is, how did I get here, or what happened to me? And she told me the story, which she says probably several people had told me before. And my response was, oh darn! And then a little while after that, an unusual thing to happen in intensive care, I started singing. I remember reading an article in Reader's Digest one time about a man who was essentially mostly paralyzed, and his lungs were in really good condition, and he was in a primitive culture, and they were trying to figure out why he was in such good condition, and then they heard him sing. that singing was good exercise when you hadn't been using your lungs. And I knew I hadn't been using my lungs. So I sang.
What did you sing?
My first thing I sang was Glory to God on High.
Huh.
Because I was quite aware of the fact that I'm aware now even more how close I came to dying. And I knew that the fact that I could, all my fingers worked and my mind seemed to be working, that I had a lot to be thankful for. And so the first thing I sang was Glory to God on High and Hallelujah. And then I sang the Mishabera. My background is I was born in a Catholic family, and I was raised Catholic, and I married a Jewish woman, and over the years I fell in love with the Jewish religion, and about 3 or 4 years ago I converted to Judaism. So the Mishabera is a song for healing from the Jewish faith, and the other one is thanks to God. So I felt the two
were
appropriate.
Yeah.
And then after that, my daughter and some of her friends were there, and they were going to leave in a little while to go to rehearsal because they were in the musical Oliver. And I did Oliver when I was in high school, so we did Oliver show tunes for a while.
That's good.
Singing them in the intensive care. It was very fun. So then I was only in intensive care for about another day or so. And then I went to the general hospital, and I was only there for 4 days. And then I was transferred to Island Health and Rehab, which is like a half block from my house, which was really great. And my neighbors brought me food, which I liked, because I'm very picky about food. They had really good PT people at Island Health and Rehab, and they got me, you know, walking at least on my right foot. My problem was that I as well as the other injuries I told you about, I've got to tell you, I had 3 broken ribs on my right side and 1 broken rib on the left side, and my shoulder blade had a crack in it, which the doctors didn't know about until I started talking. I said, my shoulder feels kind of funny. It feels like things are slipping around that shouldn't be slipping around. So they went back and looked at the x-rays, and they found a hairline crack. So I couldn't use crutches because the side that I would have to really put the pressure on was opposite my broken foot. Also had 3 broken ribs and a broken shoulder blade. So I've been mostly in a wheelchair. The things that are great, my face is totally unaffected. I mean, I landed on my back, so my face doesn't have any scarring on it. My major scars are around my torso. My wife said at some point there were 13 tubes going in and out of me. So there are little holes here and here where they put things in. There were two drain lines for draining the space between the lung and my chest wall, and that's how they reinflate a collapsed lung. They put a little vacuum in it, sucks it back out. And the first one they put in wasn't low enough, so they put in 2. So I got 2 scars, one between one set of ribs and another one right below it, another set of ribs. And so when I'm wearing a shirt, and if I were wearing long pants, you wouldn't see any of my scars. So I got a nice scar on my knee, which is pretty well healed at this point.
Yeah. How was the pain?
Great drugs. That's what
great
I
drugs.
Have to say. There was the first time I really noticed pain when I went up to the general wing of the hospital. They asked me how my pain was, and I said in a category from 0 to 10 how my pain was. And I said, oh, it's pretty mild, it's like 2. And so then they decided that I didn't need any pain drugs. And then a few hours later, when the pain drugs were starting to wear off, I had some of this residue blood at the bottom of my lungs and mixture of that and mucus, and I had to cough this up. With 4 broken ribs, I'm trying to cough this up, and I'm going, doctors, can I have those pain meds now? It took 2 doses, and they can only give you like about 4 hours apart. So it was like 5 hours before I could really kick this thing out. So then after that, I learned the importance of making sure you had enough drugs on board all the time. And so there was only one other time. There was a time when I was at home, and I had thought I had taken my evening dose of medicine, which includes right now, the only time I'm taking narcotics is at night. I'm just doing with extra strength Tylenol during the day. And so I forgot to take my thing, and then about 3 o'clock in the morning I said to my wife,
"It hurts.
Something is really wrong." So she went over to my Medi-Set and she gave it a shake and she said, "Whoops, I thought you told me you took your 11 o'clock dose." And I said, "I thought I did." So I hadn't taken them, and so I took them at that point, but it takes a while before they kick in. And it felt like I was going to remember the accident.
Huh.
It seemed like a lot of the memory of the accident was
pain.
And I didn't remember anything. The pain medication finally kicked in, but I became aware how much I am still very dependent on narcotics and painkillers to keep the level down. So during the day I take about 6 Tylenol through the process of the day, and at night I take a narcotic that gets me through the night. I'm taking vitamin pills and calcium pills. And
oh, you look good, I must say. I mean,
I'm rolling myself around. I'm at physical therapy twice a week. I made it to my school twice, and one time I was there when the students were still there, and they were real happy to see me, and it was, I felt energized. That was one of the longest days I'd had, because I also had a Squeaky Wheels board of directors meeting that night, so I was up from early in the morning till about 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah, I met you there, and see you pushing yourself and trying to... I mean, that's quite something, certainly when you're sitting on a wheelchair and you have to go everywhere with your wheelchair.
Yeah.
And tell us about that, too. I mean, just certainly how you become...
Well, I've learned a lot about human factors and the problems people who are mobility impaired run into. I mean, just a sloping driveway can cause big problems, and the cuts that they make for driveways can be too steep to actually get up. Excuse me, I'm gonna cough. So it's been a real eye-opener for me, although I've been somewhat aware, because before my accident, I'm a bicycle commuter, and so I ride my bicycle a lot, and I use it for errands. I don't have a tendency to use it for just recreation. I've been doing a little more of that lately. And the people in the hospital were amazed by the speed of my recovery, and one of the things they said, "Well, you must have been in really good shape." And I go, "Well, it's not like I go to a health club or anything, I just ride my bicycle." And they said, "Bicycle riding, very good exercise." And so I guess it is. I mean, they say I was in really good shape.
You were saying your students were happy to see you when you
people
came back there.
I mean,
and people were so, I mean, suddenly they learned that something happened. I remember, but I think it was there when they say, something terrible happened to Chris, you know,
yeah,
I hope he can't make it.
Well, one of the strange things is when I got home, I could go through my email. And my email, a lot of it is sort of group email, listservs and that sort of thing. And so there were these emails about my accident.
Yeah.
And so, did you hear Chris Stanley was in a terrible accident? And then the reply was, "Well, I know several Chris's. What does his bicycle look like?" Oh, that guy. Oh, that's terrible. And then already when I was in the hospital, we started putting a book together of all the cards I received from people. And the department director, he came in on the first day that he could. He came in the Monday after I got out of intensive care. But, of course, a lot of people were frustrated because they came to visit me and I was already gone. Because when I was in the nursing home, I wasn't there very long. When I was in the hospital, I wasn't there very long. So I kept frustrating people by
moving patient.
The moving patient. But I will say, there was a week when I was really unconscious, but there were probably over 1,000 people who were praying for my health.
Huh, that's great.
Everybody who had heard about my accident, who belonged to a prayer circle or something, had all the people in their prayer circle praying for me. We have a friend who's a political scientist, and his specialty is the Middle East. And when he got the email of my accident, he was in Jerusalem. Huh. And the email that he sent us, he said that he had the Jews, Muslims, and Christians all praying for me in the holy city of Jerusalem, which is, you know, really...
Economical wonderful. Healing.
Yes. Well, you know, I felt the love. And some of the writing I've done about my accident... I say one of the blessings of it is very few people have the privilege of knowing how much they are loved before they pass away. And there was, I mean, such a community outcry and this love and prayer sent in my way. I really felt it did make a difference in my healing. Although, of course, I got really good doctoring as well. Mm-hmm. But I think the two
sort of
together.
Hurt.
I don't think it hurts to have prayers. Yeah. And I felt, as I was recovering, and I'm still got a long way to go in the recovery, that I wanted to give something back to the community. And I felt that a terrible thing had happened, and some good had to come out of it. And so one of my first activities when I got home was to call the principal at the local high school and say, "My name is Chris Stanley, and you want me to come and talk to your students."
So what did he say?
He said, once I told him my story, he said, "Great, absolutely."
So what class? You said high school.
The high school, they had only one driver's ed class running, so I came and talked to them first. They had a PE class that involved bicycling safety, and I came and talked to all the sessions of that. I came and talked to a couple of health classes, and then West Sound Academy, which is a combination high school and junior high school. It's a private school up in Kingston. I also went and talked with them. They have a morning session. And that one, I had to condense my talk down to 20 minutes, and I just made it.
You have to condense it more than but on voice and memory. Let you talk and talk and talk.
That felt good. And, you know, I did some organizational work, and I made some notes and stuff to go in with things that I wanted to cover.
Did you have, you know, recollection of what their interests were, or how did they react, or... is that something that... Because my impression is, it's never going to happen to me, or...
That's,
you know,
not the reaction I got.
No.
I mean, the reason I wanted to talk to them is because teenagers can sniff hypocrisy in the air. And I said that the feedback I had gotten about their recent stage thing about drunk driving had not gone over well with the teenagers, because they said, well, it was stage makeup, it was sound effects, I mean, it wasn't a real accident, you know. It smelled to them like hypocrisy all over the place. And I said, I'm the real thing. I mean, I was thrown 80 feet by a car. The woman was looking for her cell phone. I can tell my story. And what I tell them in the end is, think about the consequences of your actions. And I wanted them to understand that driving...
serious thing.
...is a serious thing. And we take it too lightly in our culture, because a lot of the time when you're driving, it's really easy.
Oh, yeah, it is.
You know, most of the time you're driving, it's
easier
like
than 20, biking.
20% of your driving skill is involved. But you never know when somebody's going to do something goofy in front of you, and suddenly you're going to need 80%, 90% of your driving skill to save your life. Or maybe somebody else's life. Or maybe keep from damaging your car. And so I told them about an incident when I had been driving for 15 years. And on a beautiful sunny day, with no other car on the highway, and I drove into a tree.
Really?
I drove into a tree. And so I said, I was driving while distracted. What happened is I was driving along, and a spider, which had been sitting up on my sun visor, dropped into my lap. And I looked into my lap, and I didn't realize it, but I accidentally turned the wheel slightly. I went across the lane of oncoming traffic,
jeez,
hit the curb, then I hit my brake, and then I hit the tree. The car was in the shop for 2 months. They never did a perfect job. It had scratches in the finish still. All these things up. All I had done when the spider dropped into my lap was come to a gradual stop and then look.
Yeah.
Which is the appropriate thing to do when you're distracted. Don't look around. Keep your eyes on the road. So I was very fortunate. In my case, nobody else got hurt. It was just the car that got hurt. And the woman who hit me, and that's another thing, is to talk about what happened to her. I mean, in a year, I will probably be completely healed from my accident. I mean, I'll have a piece of metal in my leg, and I'll have a piece of metal in my neck, and I'll probably be setting off alarms in airports and stuff, but I'll be healed. This poor woman, she can't take back what she did. She can't take back the pain and suffering that she caused a lot of people around me. I was very fortunate in the time when people didn't know whether I was going to live or die. I was asleep. It wasn't a question for me. But a lot of people suffered. And she's got to live with this for her life. And it was only a few seconds reaching for that phone. And so what I suggest to the students is that at least for the first 5 years you're driving, consider when you turn that ignition key on, turning off the cell phone. Do you answer the cell phone when you're in the shower? Do you need it on all the time? You decide when it's on and when it's off. So, and I got favorable responses. Some parents told me that their kids were impressed by what I said. Some kids were impressed. Some kids started bicycling, who weren't bicycling as much, but they made sure they had helmets. I show them my helmet. It's very impressive. And I talk about the things I've done to be safe, because I've been commuting on my bicycle almost all my life. Several jobs I've had, I've gone back and forth by bicycle. And I'm very careful. And I never stick anything in my ear, so I can always hear the cars behind me. But it doesn't help when they're going too fast. And they change lanes suddenly. And Bainbridge is a wonderful place. It's a small island. I mean, every time I'm out, people see me and they wave to me. And they see me and they go, "My God, you're doing so well." And I am doing very well. I mean, I have moments, usually in the evening, when I'm just kind of worn out from the length of the day, and I'm tired and sore. But I'm healing really well.
And how long did they say before you can walk, for instance? Or
They won't say. What they told me is it depends on, because sometimes legs that have multiple breaks, some of the breaks will seal up, and then it sends a signal to the body, I'm healed. And then it stops healing. And if they say if that's the case, then they go in, they put a bone graft in. They essentially go in and irritate, so it starts healing again.
Still a long process.
It will be a long process.
The accident didn't happen that long ago. You're feeling much better.
I feel much
better. But it's still a long process.
It's a long process. Once you get off your legs, your muscles start to atrophy. And doing physical therapy, and I've come a long way. When I was in the hospital, when I first doing, I could not lift my right elbow up. If I want to lift my right elbow up, I have to push down with my fingers because of all the broken bones. It wouldn't do it. And so the first thing I worked on was the flexibility with my arm, and now it's amazing.
And you get a lot of exercise with a wheelchair, your arms?
Yeah,
no,
somewhat.
Not that much. I was wondering, that's sort of a part of the story, really, that suddenly, you experienced like what it is to be in a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah. It is eye-opening. And
your mobility being restricted.
The width of doors becomes real critical, and ledges that come up to doors and stuff like that. And there'll be some days, there's two routes. I visit my mother at least twice a week. My mother has dementia, and things aren't entirely clear to her. And I've been an anchor in her life the 2 years that she's been living up here. We brought her up here so that I could be near her and give her the attention she needed. And I used to visit her pretty much every day, just for 20 minutes, just some time. And then it was three or four weeks before I could see her after my accident. We brought her to the nursing home when I was still in the nursing home. She didn't really recognize me. I had, by that time, grown a mustache, so I looked different, and I was in a wheelchair, and it was a different place. But when I actually came, I had a bus bring me, the Access Transit brought me to her house, and I came in, and I had shaved my mustache off by that time. And sorry, she recognized me because it was familiar surroundings and stuff like that. So there's a lot of key elements there, and I still am a bit of an anchor to her, and she's always disappointed when I have to leave, but I try and see her. So best way I have for going to see her is just to push myself over there, it's a few blocks, and there are some days when I can take a little more rigorous route, which has a very steep curb cut for a driveway, and I have to actually get up a little speed and then hit it and then keep pushing through it, or I can't make it over it. I can't make it over just by trying to do brute force. And then if I can't do that, then I have to go up through a parking lot, which I feel is not as safe as going up along the sidewalk. And cars on Bainbridge do not always stop when you're in the crosswalk. I think lately they've been a little better, but I've had days when four or five cars will pass.
Huh.
And I had one day when the first car who saw me stopped, and the second car did not notice that he was stopping. They were not paying adequate attention,
yes,
and they ran right into the back of him.
Yeah.
Now, I won't go into the street until all the cars have stopped. Don't want anybody to hit me. I just, it was one of my fears is that, boy, if I got hit real hard or something like that, this fine work that the doctors did that has meant that I'll have complete mobility, I'd hate to see that undone.
Can you tell the story about the reaction on your dog, the impact on your dog? Because
oh,
I thought it was
oh.
sort of a funny story. You know, it's a gruesome experience at the same time.
Well, you know, the poor dog, let's see, about 2 years ago, his original owner, my stepfather, passed away. And he's become attached to me, and he really likes me. But I'm not a dog person. I'm really a cat person. But he's a great dog, just a wonderful, real sweet, very large, Sheltie dog. And so the question is, how did he respond?
Yeah, because I was saying,
yeah.
The poor dog, I mean, if he was attached, how did he react? I mean, he was probably sad what happened. He was concerned what happened.
Yeah, well, just the opposite. What happened is, the woman who ordinarily cleans our house is a wonderful woman. Who likes the dog, and the dog likes her very much, agreed to take him and have him live at home with her. Because while I was in the hospital, my wife was spending a lot of time in the hospital. Sometimes she wouldn't come home. And we didn't need a dog to be taken care of that had to be walked and stuff like that. So Nancy just took the dog, and when she was either cleaning our house or cleaning houses near our house, she would leave the dog in our house so he would feel sort of at home. And so finally, I'm at home enough now, and things have calmed down enough. The dog has come home, and he's lovesick. He misses Nancy. He's only eating half. He doesn't eat his morning meal. He won't eat his morning meal until dinner time. So he looks good because he's slimmed down a little bit, but he's just kind of lovesick, and that, and he's just going to have to get over it, I think, because he's living here now.
Yeah.
But, you don't always know how. My daughter was very lucky. I mean, when the police came here and told her that I had been in a bad accident, first place,
shock.
They didn't know how bad I was hurt. But secondly, my daughter has a number of friends from high school, and she had about three friends here when that happened.
So.
And while I was in the hospital, she never had to sleep in the house alone. She'd either be staying at a friend's house, or a friend would be staying here, so that...
Good support.
Yeah, good. Very good support. Again, I think this is part of living on a small island.
Yeah.
Really, people stick together and come together during emergencies.
And we went together to a meeting about, what could be eventually the regulatory consequences. Do you have any idea about that? I mean, I think... some thinking about it. If any... Because maybe it's just something more general, as you said. Already.
My accident ended up being on the Seattle News, the TV news, ended up several articles in the Bainbridge Island, and I think it's not because of my accident. I think it's because there was a group that started immediately after my accident to propose banning cell phones on Bainbridge Island. Now, that's news. My getting hit by a car? No, that's not news. Banning cell phone, that's news. And there is some logic to that. There are 30 countries now that have banned cell phone use in cars. And cell phones are very distracting. And the police department has noticed an increase in accidents caused by distracted drivers. And they say it isn't just cell phones. There are other things as well. But cell phones are definitely playing a part in this. My response, partly because of who I am and what I do for a living, I am an educator, was what people need to know. Driving is not as easy as you think. If you talk to people, if you educate them, maybe they will use the cell phones less. And there actually is some studies done about places that the legislation went through, and they're not sure. After the legislation goes through, yes, accidents caused by cell phones do go down. But they don't know if they go down because of the law or because of all the commotion that was brought up by getting the law passed and all the discussion about, maybe cell phones in cars is not a good idea. Immediately after my accident, one of the people who knew me was involved in a local construction company, and he made it company policy that you cannot use your cell phones while driving a company vehicle. we heard that through the squeaky wheels in our investigations about cell phones and cell phone law, some insurance companies require their insurees, which are businesses, to not have their employees use cell phones while working in cars because of the increase in accidents.
So they would have somehow maybe the data to require that to some extent. But it's difficult when you read articles, I mean, Google that a little, and you have confusing evidence of people saying, yeah, no, it was distracting, but the other thing is distracting, and we cannot.
Well, it also blocks vision. Most people are right-handed. Uh-huh. And the other thing is, try to turn your signal on when you're holding a cell phone and holding a steering wheel.
What are you going to let go of?
It's silly. So we're seeing more people not signaling on the aisle.
Yeah.
One thing I said in that meeting was that, in a way, Bainbridge Island was blessed with poor cell phone reception for a long time.
Yeah.
It's only recently that you could get decent cell phone reception on much of the island. And so this has caused, I think, a faster transition to bad driving habits than other places where there was a more gradual. You know, suddenly we went from really bad reception to fairly decent reception. Suddenly a bunch of people are getting cell phones. They were putting it off because of our poor reception. And so I think that has been one of the factors that is leading this very sudden increase in accidents.
Do you have a cell phone yourself?
I hate phones in general. I don't know why I hate phones. I do know now why I hate phones.
Yeah.
I'm dyslexic, which means one of the things it means is that I don't remember numbers and letter combinations very well. Oftentimes when you're on a phone, people will try to give you information. And about the fourth time I ask them to slow down and give me the information slower, if they don't know me, they start speaking to me in a condescending voice, and they assume I'm an idiot. Truth of the matter is, most dyslexics are the opposite of idiots. So over the years, I don't like phones. I refuse to carry a cell phone, although my wife's been really pushing me when I'm in a wheelchair and I'm in a vulnerable situation.
So do you have one or not? No.
We have
tell us everything.
Three cell phones in our house, and I generally refuse to carry one. I would never use one in a car. I wouldn't use one on a bicycle. I think using one on a bicycle is crazy.
Yeah, people
even
are using
hands-free because you're going to be distracted in the ears. You need to hear what's going on behind you. You need your focus on what you're doing when you're bicycling or driving. It can't go anyplace else. And cell
so basically, you're still saying you don't think it's a good thing to use a phone when you're driving or
biking. No, and I have a friend who I was talking to, a former student of mine, who's now in charge of the model-making department for Zebco Fishing Equipment. And he has a cell phone, and he says usually he won't answer it in the car, and he won't touch it. But sometimes if the traffic's real slow and he's expecting a call from his mother, he'll answer. And when he does, his mother says, "Are you in a car? Your voice sounds a little edgy and irritated. Did you answer a cell phone in your car?" "You did you? Well, I'm hanging up." Because he's a little irritated when he's talking on the cell phone,
nervous.
Because he knows he really shouldn't be. And I've gotten email messages and phone calls from friends who will no longer answer cell phones in cars. And this is a result of my story. And so I've been trying to get my story out, which is why I'm doing this.
Thank you. It is a long story.
It is
but
a
it's
long
interesting.
Story.
It's important to.
And
to
other
see
people
what
have gotten new bicycle helmets.
Huh.
Or started wearing bicycle helmets.
That's good too.
And that is important. That's equally important. And I was given two bicycle helmets. The sheriff's department gave me a new
honorary helmet,
a nice helmet, and some friends who came and visited me in the nursing home brought me a new helmet. And so I'm well outfitted.
So you're ready, but there's still some time before you can bike, right?
And I have to get I have an old bike. I have a bicycle that I bought in England. When I went, I did a cycle tour of Europe. Essentially, it was France and a bit of Switzerland. You know, the real flat parts of Europe, Switzerland. And I bought the bicycle in London, and I held on to this bicycle for about 24, 25 years before I bought a new bicycle. And I said, well, you know, I ride a bicycle 25 years. I can buy a nice bicycle. So the bicycle I was riding the day of the accident was $3,500 bicycle.
Whew!
A custom-built bicycle specifically for me. Fortunately, it was insured. And so I'll have my old bicycle to start riding with, and then once I'm really back to shape, I'm going to be remeasured because it's possible my dimensions changed because of the accident. And then I'll get that bicycle because it was amazing. You know, I've been driving the same bicycle for a long time, and it was so old that components were failing on it. And I replaced the components, and they wouldn't be the same as the original, and they'd be a little different. And it got harder and harder to bicycle on it. And I just assumed I was getting old. And I got my new bicycle that was built exactly to my specifications, and suddenly...
A new world.
I could go up hills that I had stopped going up. It was wonderful. I felt young.
Biking keeps you young, I guess.
Well, bicycling does. And this year is going to be... I'm going to have a really big birthday party this year. This year I will turn 50.
Very young still.
Yes, young, but the big party is not because I'm turning 50. It's because I'm still alive.
Yes. I have one question, if I can, about the person who hit you. You know, he said it's difficult for her in terms of healing as well.
Yeah.
But do you have any idea what happens? You know, what type of response really there is? Is there an impact? You know, what happens when someone... Because it could help people maybe to... Not about not in a repressing mood, but just thinking, you know, be careful because that could have some serious consequences. And it's... anybody who has been in this type of accident, very limited, just to think, for instance, I just opened the door and it without looking, you know, and you hit someone. And it's true, and it's just something, and in attention, it's just 1 second, as
if you do it
dramatic consequences. Yeah.
And you kill the person, it's manslaughter. Vehicular manslaughter. And that can mean jail time.
Yeah.
The police who took the photographs of the accident site checked the skid marks of the bicycle where the bumper hit it, left a skid mark, measured the distance of my flight, which was 80 feet, they were essentially preparing for a vehicular manslaughter case. Fortunately, it's not that kind of case. The DA, district attorney, is the person who's going to decide what kind of suit follows. It'll probably be something like driving while distracted or inattentive driving or something like that. And I think it's about a $530 fine.
And how long did it take for the DA? You know, because very often...
I don't know that he's decided.
Yeah. Anyway,
I haven't heard back from the police department that has happened. The other thing that happened is that her car was impounded as evidence. And so she lost the use of her car. I lost the use of my bicycle, but I can't ride a bicycle right now. Anyway, my bicycle's also in impound. At some point, they will release those vehicles. Her car got a few dents on it. Bad dent on the roof. And a broken windshield, but that can all be repaired, and I'm sure it won't be total.
So it has very serious consequences. I mean, when the dog was barking, we just were talking about the impact on the person who hit you, and I think it's important for the public as well to realize that, because it's part of the maybe it's part of the motivation to realize that, you know, not only you're going to do something terrible, maybe to somebody else, but it has a huge impact on yourself when you do that, feeling the responsibility.
There was an accident about a year or two ago where there was a cyclist who was wearing dark clothing, did not have lights on his bicycle, and was cycling essentially in the dark. And the driver, through no fault of their own, so this is a driver who did nothing bad, looked, didn't see anybody there, pulled out, and hit the cyclist, through no fault of their own. But this poor youth has got incredible guilt because they killed somebody.
Yeah.
And they did nothing.
Sure. Well,
and it wasn't their fault.
Yeah.
I mean, the fault was the person on the bicycle should have had lights.
Yeah.
Because when you're coming sideways up on a car, and this is the thing I've told people, when you're coming sideways up on a car, they can't see you unless you have lights.
Yeah.
The reflectors and all that do not work unless there are headlights pointing at you. So riding at night, you have to have flashers and lights. It's not fair to the cars around you.
And is that regulated? Is that that people don't follow those?
You are supposed to have that stuff on your car.
There's still a lot of education to do that people respect. I mean, wear the helmet or wear some type of clothing or lights or stuff.
When I see, and it's usually young people around me, although sometimes it's adults, cycling past without helmets, I say, you'd look better in a helmet. I've decided, careful what I say, because I don't want to. I want them to think of helmets as a good thing, not as something imposed by other people. But it's just a good idea to have a helmet on. And I think we're mostly a vain society, so I have to actually say, well, you look better with a helmet on. The helmets nowadays, they're cool and swept looking. It looks pretty good.
My daughters. I'm French, and my daughters are visiting their grandmother in France.
No,
so having a hard time wearing
there.
The helmet. No, because we call them very often, and my wife is a nurse by training, so she has seen so many accidents that she's absolutely adamant you have to wear your helmet.
Yeah.
So they're making an effort, but it's very hard for them.
Yeah.
Although now I see, you know, in the Tour de France, all the cyclists, all the runners, they have wearing helmets. It's, you know, obliged to anyway. So, but it's most of the people, I think, still don't wear helmets.
Well, it's. I think Americans, in some ways, are more safety conscious than Europeans, because the smoking rate in the U.S. went down first before it went down in Europe.
Yes,
and
it's a perception that it cannot happen to you. You're in denial of the accidents. They're just not, and that's the education process, really. And
but
it hits you when it's too late, or hits you because your friend of yours has an accident.
When I was 20, I went bicycling in Europe, and I felt much safer as a cyclist in France, because people expect to see cyclists, and they have a tremendous respect for cyclists. And so I think it's probably a little safer there, and perhaps because it's safer, they didn't think about helmets as much. But, I mean, the helmets are great technology, and without that helmet, I certainly wouldn't be speaking to you now. I don't know whether or not I'd be alive or dead, but I certainly would not have my brain intact.
Maybe some helmet company will contact you, dude.
Well, actually,
they did.
one of the things that I did is I sent out a notice to my professional organization. I'm a model maker by profession, and model makers make prototypes of everything. And so, one of the fellows who makes prototype bicycle helmets contacted me. He said, "You got any pictures of that helmet?" And I go, "Well, actually, first thing he asked me for was the make and model." Which, I mean, unfortunately, it's a discontinued helmet. You can't buy it anymore. But that's the helmet I would want. This is a good helmet. And so he said, so I sent him the make and model, and I sent him five pictures of the helmet. He says, "This is impressive. Can I forward it to the Bicycle Helmet Safety Committee?" And so it's gone to the various highest levels of people who set the standards for bicycle helmets. It did what it's supposed to do. It crushed, it fractured, it splintered, and by doing that, it absorbed impact instead of all the impact going straight to my brain.
Yeah,
because that's an incredible acceleration. My head hitting the top of that car, and I left a good sized dent in the top of the car, which was very impressive. But, you know, someone who rides a bicycle, and I've been having an argument with the kid who lives right across the path from me, you're in co-housing, and he's finally wearing a helmet, but he's begrudgingly. And my position is that if you're sitting on the seat of the bicycle, you should have a helmet on. I mean, if you're bicycling from your house to your bike shed, which for me is about 200 feet, I put my helmet on. If I don't put my helmet on, I'm walking the bicycle. So if I'm sitting on my bicycle and bicycling, you probably will see me with my helmet on. I can only think of one two-block period in the past 5 years where I knowingly went without a helmet because I was in a very time constraint and it turned out I had forgotten my helmet. I couldn't believe I had forgotten my helmet. And I had to go back and get it. But it made me very nervous. I was very careful, very cautious about everything I did, but it was a time constraint. Normally, I would have walked the bicycle two blocks to go back and get my helmet. Because I am adamant that helmets... when I was 15, I was in a bad bicycle accident where a cat ran in front of me, and I hit my brakes really hard, and I the bicycle stopped, and I shot over the handlebars, and I did a tuck and roll, and I went to the hospital, and I got 8 stitches in my head. And we didn't really have helmets back when I was 15. They weren't, and they weren't very good, the ones that were around.
Not at all. What happened? It's a little evolution. I'm not going to go into that. It's a long story.
Technology in them is wonderful.
But it's really something that they used, you know, when you're a child. We didn't have helmets.
I mean,
I guess it came maybe from the number of accidents. But people say you have to wear helmets.
Yeah. And but it was something to sell.
I guess so too. But it's strange that you have it, same thing for tobacco to some extent, that at one point you have people dying or having accidents, and there is no perception. It takes a while for society to decide if this is big enough a problem that we're going to do something about it.
But bicycle helmets, wonderful thing. And what the big thing that they do is they'll take a minor accident and keep it minor.
Yeah.
In my case, I had a huge accident, and they kept it from being fatal or massive brain damage. As it was, I had 5 bleeds inside my brain, but they were never so bad that they caused massive damage.
So thank you for the helmet.
Helmet is great.
And then we are going maybe to continue a little giving talks and being involved to some extent with that.
And I still want to talk to the automotive industry. One of the things I said, people said, you know, of all people, why should it happen to you? And I go, well, actually, it's a pretty good thing happened to me. For one thing, I was strong enough that I survived. If it happened to someone else, they might be dead. Another one is that I'm a good storyteller. I can get the story out, and I don't have a lot of enemies, so people will actually feel bad that it happened to me. And so it might actually change the way they do things. They might actually stop using the cell phone, or they might think more carefully about the sloppy sandwich before they eat it while driving, or wear a bicycle helmet. All those things are wonderful changes that people can do. And the last thing is, I actually have contacts in the automotive industry. I teach students how to carve cars out of clay. I have students working at Honda, Ford, General Motors.
What do you want from the automotive industry?
I want them to pay attention, to say, maybe we're making the inside of cars too busy. Maybe we aren't telling people that it takes a certain amount of attention. The whole idea of television sets in cars.
Yeah, it's true.
About very fancy stereos with lots of buttons. Bad idea. I recently was watching something on the internet about Stephen Jobs talking about the new iPod and BMW interchange, which I think is actually interesting. I was looking at it, and the interface is that you plug your iPod into a cable, and it sits inside your glove compartment, so you're not going to mess with it, because messing with that thing would be a bad idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And the controls for the iPod are in the steering wheel. You don't even take your eyes off, and the readout is down where you would read your speed and stuff like that.
So they really integrated the iPod
into
the design of the car.
So they totally integrated into the car so that it is not a distraction. It is not another thing like the radio. The old design of radios was good. You turned a knob, you adjusted it to the station. You never looked at the radio. You listened, and you turned one knob. Now you got these buttons, presets. Oh, I mean, people are going the wrong way with cars. I mean, and some people have said if you look at European cars, they're much simpler inside than U.S. cars. I mean, the thing is, I think they wanted to show, to stand out in the market, will make the inside fancier. We'll make more doodads to keep people want to buy our car. And it's going the wrong way. And so, I haven't written this letter yet, but this is one of the letters that I had in mind early on after my accident, was the people I know in the automotive industry.
Did I recall right that you said if you had been hit by a bigger car, it would have been very dangerous too? SUV are not good news for safety.
Yeah, well,
because of course they're bigger cars, so.
There are bigger cars, and the fact the car was very low, I slid right on top of the hood and hit the window. the car had been higher up, my pelvis would have hit the edge of the car.
Yeah. Well, I think this was a very, very long story. Very interesting one. In fact, it's almost 1 hour. So thank you for all your time and giving this interesting story. Now you have this very quiet cat on your laps. So that's good. So thank you very much, Chris. And have a good healing. And maybe we can talk again to learn about what happens with your contact with the automotive industry or else.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Take
My
care.
Pleasure.
Here we are.
Good.
Thanks a lot. Hey, you'll have it.
You have to give me your URL or whatever.
Yeah, it will take a little while, maybe,
but
because
I want to hear the other stuff you got there, so
yeah.
I can see what.
Sure.
Let me see what. You can write on the back of my exercise, my leg.